Yeah. His. Yeah, like all kinds of connections with that.
You got those types.
Yeah, oh yeah. That's exactly right.
Flash. Flash, I have you. Not in the US Supreme Court, in the Fourth Circuit.
In the Fourth Circuit.
I never argued in that. Counsel?
May it please the court, my name is Maurice Baskin, representing the appellant in this case, Abian Svoboda. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal at the court's discretion. The first issue in this Davis-Bacon appeal is whether the Department of Labor gave fair warning to this government contractor as to work restrictions that the department decided later should apply to Connecticut bridge projects. And of course, we're talking about the restriction to use only painters and not laborers or carpenters who are also listed in the applicable wage determination. The critical holding of the Administrative Review Board, which unfortunately the district court never actually addressed, which is the fundamental due process violation, is the statement of the board on page 448 of the joint appendix, in which it said it was incumbent on the respondent contractors to go beyond the list of job classifications on the wage determination to ascertain the actual local area practice. That holding is fundamentally contradicted by this court's rulings in the Gates case, the GE case, the satellite case. Judge Edwards in U.S. versus Chrysler said it best, said it is basic hornbook law in the administrative context that the application of a regulation in a particular situation may be challenged on the ground that it does not give fair warning that allegedly violative conduct was prohibited.
The problem for you is that you have Fry Brothers, which is their law, and it's not secret law. It has been republished. Basis for their regulations, and we cited it.
This case has blown Fry Brothers completely out of its original boundaries, relying on another case that really first did so, which was the American Building Automation case. And what that case did for the first time was to say that it is that not only do union work rules apply, but it's up to the contractors to find out what they are. That is not what Fry Brothers held. In Fry Brothers, it was well known that it was carpentry work. The contractor admittedly knew it. He tried for a conformance to get around that, and when that failed, he just went ahead and employed laborers and helpers on his own. That was Fry Brothers.
Any attempt here to get a conformance?
There was no need to get a conformance because the contractor had no reason to know that he couldn't use laborers or carpenters in the first place. In other words, the union rules that the department is relying on here or secret rules. That's the secret we're talking about. Although we also contend Fry Brothers was not published, this is beyond Fry Brothers.
They had the list of classifications.
They have three classifications listed. Painters. In fact, if you just take a look at the wage determination, I think it's critical to this case. This is all the contractors get. It's at page 271 of the joint appendix. There's several in a row. But just looking at the first one, they're all pretty similar. Page 273 shows the painters classification. This is all the contractors get. And what does it say? It says painters, bridge construction, brush, roller, blasting, sand, water, spray, et cetera, spray. It doesn't say anything about debris collection. It doesn't say anything about lead abatement. It doesn't say anything about rigging of scaffolds.
What about the notations?
Oh, sure, the secret code. It says painters.
Well, you don't argue it's secret. There's no claim that your client didn't know what the reference was.
The reference is that there's a painter's union. It does not say that you have to look at the painter's work rules, nor does it say that the painter's work rules include lead abatement, for example, or rigging or debris collection. That's what the department seems to be missing here. It's not enough to say that the painters is where they got the wage rates from. If you go back to Fry Brothers, it says that the department, in Fry Brothers, the board said that the Labor Department must see to it that the work classifications come with the wage determination. A contractor could read that decision and read this and say, well, we assume that if the painters union claims some other work, the department would have let us know that.
But you know what I don't understand about this case is your client admittedly has done a lot of Davis-Bacon work. Is that correct? Right.
Yes, 500 times.
Now, the implication then is in those 500 times, he hasn't been complying with what the department views as the requirements of Davis-Bacon.
Actually, the only conclusion one can draw from someone who's done it 500 times without a single government complaint without a single union agent telling him he was doing it wrong, is that he had every reason to think he was doing it right, and that he had no fair warning that he was doing it wrong. Imagine you drive by, you're driving to work every day, 500 days in a row, and you go by a speed limit sign that says, observe local speed limits.
No, it may be that he assumed in all of those cases, save this one, exactly what he's supposed to assume. That is, if there are questions, he knows how to ask, because he knows what the government wage determinations are based on.
Well, his testimony was
the government can't, at least I don't know how they could possibly do it, understand precisely all of what you're going to be doing and then write particularized classifications for all of your work. And that's why you have the challenge pre-bid, if you think they're wrong. And then once that's over, you can't challenge the wage determination, and you have conformance.
Well, that's in fact the government's argument. It's impractical for them to identify all the job duties. It's easy for them to do
no,
it. The states have done it. How does the court?
On each individual contractor's work situation. The contractor understands how the contractor is proposing to operate, and that's why you have conformance procedures if you want to advance an argument.
But the conformance procedures only arise when there is notice that a contract classification, entire classification, is missing. The department is pretty clear. In fact, the American Building Automation case came up in the conformance process, in which it said, well, we aren't going to give you another classification if it's anywhere in the union work rules, which, of course, you haven't known about because they were not published. All we're suggesting, frankly, is that if they want to incorporate the union work rules in the wage determination, then take the union bargaining agreements and attach them to the wage determination, or at least publish them somewhere, which was certainly not done here, and it's still not being done today.
So I understand your point about you want greater notice, but I'm still not clear why you don't get adequate notice by the statute, the regulations that are published in the Code of Federal Register. Code of Federal Regulations, and the statements that your client actually did receive from the department, both in the request for bids and then the certifications, and then the notes.
The notes?
The notes, citing the locals. The Connecticut locals.
Oh, you mean, well, when you, I thought that's what you meant by what the department gave.
Yeah.
All right, the statute says that the department will determine the wage determinations.
Mm-hmm.
It says nothing about painters, laborers. It just says the department will determine it. No help there. The regulations say the department will determine the wage determinations. It doesn't say what's going to be in them. No help there. All the contractors get is the wage determination.
With the notations.
With a notation that says painters, brush, roller, blasting, spray.
Right.
Right.
And that comes from the painters local. That's
right.
That's what one could reasonably
right.
infer
right.
from that.
Right.
It doesn't say that there's anything more to it than that.
No, but the point of the statute is to protect workers. All
not
right.
You.
So the question is, what's happening in Connecticut with bridge workers? And they give you the site of the local.
Yes.
Now, why wouldn't your client find out from the local, and then if he had any questions, go to the wage and...
Well, not even the department has said that contractors required, non-union contractors are required to talk to union locals who are notoriously hostile.
If they're confused about the basis for the wage determination, they are.
No. First of all, they had no confusion, but they're allowed to talk to unionized contractors.
But there's no evidence.
They did that. They did that.
There's no evidence that the local that was cited refused to give your client the information.
No, the contractor and the local had no direct communication.
Right.
Instead, the contractor talked to unionized contractors, subcontractors who were dealing with that same local all the time.
No, but why didn't you talk to the very local that's cited by the department? That's
because non-union contractors and unions, I don't want to dwell on this too much, but they don't get along.
No, but my point is...
I don't know how else to put it.
No.
Stipulations,
all right,
okay.
They don't get along, but the question is, don't you have some burden to try to find out the information? And if the union stonewalls you, that's a different case. But you don't
isn't
have that
the
here.
Burden? I guess I have to respectfully say that what this court has held, what you have held in all of these cases, is as the burden on the agency to notify the contractors of what the rules of the game are. And that means if,
as we talked about in a different context earlier this morning, is what level of specificity is required.
Now, I heard that come up and thought that might be the statement, and that's true. What level of specificity is required? But is it unreasonable to suggest
that you had some sort of notice? I mean, you know what the job is, you know
yes.
what Davis Bacon applies.
Right.
You have the things that Judge Rogers said. Now, as a matter of policy, if I were making the decision in the first instance, is this enough for the government to do? I don't mind saying, I'd say no. I don't think the government's done what it should have here. But I'm not going by the Dave Centel standard. I'm going by whether this is legally sufficient.
And whether...
And what's your best case that it is?
Right. And whether it is fair warning, would a reasonable person be put on adequate notice, particularly when you consider the steps that this contractor did take to try to find out? You mentioned they did not talk to the union directly, but who did they talk to? They talked to union subcontractors who said, oh, yeah, around here we do this work with laborers.
But the whole reason you don't talk to the one that's noted is because of hostility between unions, and yet you talk to other unions?
Union contractors.
Union contractors?
The ones who are actually doing the work. If
yeah,
you read...
There are union contractors in the field. There are non-union
right.
contractors in the field.
Right.
If you double-breasted out there somewhere.
Right. But in this case, this company has nothing against using union labor. They've hired union subcontractors who would be presumed, they're the ones signatory to the union contract. They would be presumed to know what the rules of the game are. You would also think that the State Department of Transportation in Connecticut, which is building bridges and renovating them all the time, would know what the local area practice was. And that State Department of Transportation told my client that they should be using laborers. In fact, they were concerned they were going to be overpaying people, so they directed them to use laborers. How can that be fair notice of if everyone of these people was unaware of this of these union work rules? How can that be fair notice from the Department of Labor when there are very easy and practical ways, contrary to what the department has suggested, practical ways that they could disclose this, as simple as attaching the union contracts, which have the jurisdictional rules, attaching them to the wage determinations? One sentence would do it, for example, would have done it.
Did you have gotten those contracts by some other means yourself?
They did get the contracts. Of course, the first contract they look at is the laborer's contract. Guess what? It claims
the work.
So how
would you have been better off if they had attached them?
Excuse me?
Would you have been any better off from a notice viewpoint if they had attached them?
Because
you're saying you didn't have enough notice.
Right.
Because they didn't attach them.
Right.
You're saying you, in fact, did see those contracts.
Yes.
How would you be any better off from a notice viewpoint if they had attached?
Because I didn't get a chance to finish that. If the union was going to claim any rules, any restrictions that are not contained in those contracts, such as exclusive right to do work, because what we have here is laborers said they do the work, painters said, no, we do the work. What is at issue here is whether only one of them is allowed to do the work. That if there's some unwritten rule, which this, it's undisputed, it's unwritten. If there's an unwritten rule to that effect, the department should be required to let people know what that is. It should say to the unions, if you want us to include your work rules, you have to tell us what they are and we'll post them for all concern. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I might.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, my name is Benton Peterson and I'm representing the Department of Labor. Despite the repeated assertions to the contrary, this case is about a direct attack on the Secretary of Labor's wage determination and the correctness of that wage determination. And it goes contrary to the Supreme Court precedent we find in Binghamton, goes contrary to the precedent in this circuit we find in Mystic, and to the statute itself, the Davis-Bacon Act. There is review of the wage determination for the process that goes behind the wage determination, the due process. Now, recognizing this, appellant seeks to clothe its attack in due process language, mm-hmm. i.e., we didn't get enough notice. But in fact, the record is clear that the appellant received abundant and definitely sufficient notice about their requirements under the Davis-Bacon Act. Specifically, the parties to the contract are obliged to know the applicable rules to the contract they're signatories to. This is the Davis-Bacon Act. This is a company that has 500 contracts under its belt, more by this point.
Yeah, and if they're correct that they'd been following the same practices for 500 contracts worth, and they suddenly get hit with a different interpretation than they've been operating under all that time, they've been assuming all that time, doesn't that support their proposition that they didn't have adequate notice?
Not at all, Your Honor. Acting assuredly when you're wrong does not make you correct. The assurance they have...
If you've been wrong for 500 times and the government let you get by with it, then the government has dug itself a pretty good hole there, haven't
Well, I mean, that's the assertion. We don't know whether that's right or wrong.
That is true. That is the assertion.
He just got through saying it was right. He can't say it's right and then try to argue from that basis.
We don't know what they, whether they may have done it correctly 500 times.
That didn't convince you were wrong in saying that.
Kurt, well, obviously, that was not briefed.
What do they get specifically? They have the statute, they have your regulations. Tell me exactly what else they get.
Precisely what they received, Judge Rogers, is first, guidance in the statute itself, that the Department of Labor, the Secretary of Labor, will provide the prevailing wage. Then the guidance comes in with the Frye Brothers precedent, which this court has already talked about with the appellant. The Frye Brothers principle is clear. I don't think there's any debate about what it says in that.
Can I ask you, suppose Frye Brothers didn't exist, just for the moment. They get the statute, the regs, they get the solicitation announcement, and then they get the actual contract.
Right.
Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Anything else?
And do they get anything else that tells them, you know, to talk to the union under the collective bargaining agreement for painters in Connecticut?
Of course, attached to the actual contract, by law would be the wage determinations themselves, mm-hmm. which would point the appellant to the appropriate union in terms of the rates that would be applied.
That and that's the notations that I keep referring
that,
to?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why are those written, in such a succinct way, if I can put it that way? I mean, maybe everybody in the industry knows.
Because everybody understands.
Well, that's exactly what one would call transparent, or are they?
Well, in the practical sense, Your Honor, yeah. As we stated in our brief, you know, at any given time, there are over 3,000 different contracts all over the country dealing with federal work in various parts of the country. These contracts and the notations attached to these contracts are not meant to be exhaustive language in terms of what the requirements are.
Is the best argument that if you get the wage specification and it has notations you don't understand, there is a regulatory process available for you to get an answer?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In this case, what you find in contracts is that either the prevailing wage is revealed by a survey, or it's revealed by the collective bargaining agreement in that local area. Those are the two avenues that you would generally get the prevailing wage as a contractor. Now, if you see the notation that indicates a survey, then you have a certain path to go down. If you see the survey, if you see the information that says this is a collective bargaining agreement based prevailing wage, then you have another path to go down. These are signposts. These are not dictionaries. These are not.
This is all pre-contract, and if you disagree, you can express your disagreement.
You can definitely express your disagreement at the administrative level.
This is pre-contract.
Pre-contract, which is a very important distinction.
Or at the very least, you can stay out of that.
Yes.
Contract.
Stay out of the contract.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's precisely why Mystic doesn't apply here, because Mystic was, at the very case of Mystic, was dealing with what happens post hoc when you, as a contractor, you've already signed on to this and you realize that somehow either the prevailing wage is wrong or something happened that you didn't bargain on in the contracting negotiation phase.
Petitioner, appellant is correct here. If they didn't have adequate notice, then this is really a post hoc analysis here.
Well, first, we don't.
It is something other than post hoc assumes they had adequate notice, which they may have. I'm
right.
Not asking you
right.
To waive that point.
Right, okay.
But we have to treat it as the same as a post hoc analysis if they don't have that.
But they didn't see conformance here either, right?
We're not in conformance at all. Right. But to the extent that they're claiming that the, assuming the hypothetical is correct and that there was no notice at all, of course
it
that
would be inadequate notice.
Or inadequate notice. Yes. If that was deemed inadequate notice, of course we're leaning more towards the Mystic framework in the sense that there are avenues for a contractor to gain review if it's deemed to be no note or inadequate notice, period. But in this, that's not this case. this case is clear on its face that there's notice not only in the statute itself, not only in the precedent of the Fry brothers, which is, as this court, I think, has indicated, is not secret law. It was before the appellant signed onto the contract. It was cited twice in this district alone. Before the appellant signed onto the contract, it was cited in 1989 in the final rule of 54 FR 4234. Before the appellant signed onto his contract, the year before, it was cited in a wage appeal board decision, the predecessor to the ARB, in Prime Roofing and Trotoris Construction Corporation, the very year before that. So to say that this is secret law would basically be saying that this is the worst kept secret in the government, but I don't believe that.
I think there'd be a lot of buying for first place.
Or perhaps one of the worst kept secrets in the government. Perhaps that is true, Your Honor. But it is clearly not secret law. And if there, and as the court has also alluded, if there's any question about what applies here, well, we only have this cryptic note. We don't know what it means. There is a process in place to get clarification about what this means. It's found in 29 CFR 5.13. That they could have availed themselves of that. A series of phone calls would have averted this whole scenario in the sense that calling the painter's union on a painting contract is not unreasonable.
Now, the wage determination, the contract proposal clearly included the painter bridge construction classification, right?
That is, yes, it did.
And if it didn't, then we'd have a different case, right?
If
it had not included.
If the signpost wasn't there, I think there would be a different case. But in this case, the signposts are all there, all flashing red. Please make yourself, avail yourself of the
process.
Well, I
think it said painter's bridge construction.
The contract itself indicates that in the notation of wage determination.
Yeah. So you have to wonder why. Never mind. That's too far down the road.
So, Your Honor, we believe that this case is very clear that it's what it is an frontal attack on the Secretary of Labor's wage determination process by trying to misclassify workers, therefore affecting the wage that those workers would be paid. We believe this is inapposite to the Supreme Court precedent and this court's precedent and the statute itself. And unless there are any more questions, we would ask that you.
Is every count of the complaint an attempt to attack the Secretary's determination?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is every count of the complaint covered by your argument that,
well,
that this is an attack on the Secretary's determination?
Our argument is that, yes, it's all a veiled attack.
Count two is a due process claim.
That is a due process claim.
So that does not come under the unreviewability criteria or precedents applicable to the Secretary's determination.
If it was a legitimate due process claim.
Oh, that's a different question.
I understand.
It is a legitimate claim. It may or may not be successful, but I don't think you can say this is a bad faith argument.
I mean, you have answers on the merits, on the estoppel and on lack of due process.
That's what I was going to get to. In your brief, you go to the merits on these arguments.
I mean, the district court overreached a little bit on those, but you have easy answers on the merits.
Yes, right. Yes.
Copying, I had a smile, copying the ALJs, copying the brief. We've had those cases. I mean, I've had district court judges who just parroted every single word, typos included.
And a
trial brief, and the case law is
ever since Bessemer City, in that case, a district judge simply adopted the findings of fact that were drafted by the law firm, and Supreme Court said that was okay. Once he adopted them,
as long as the findings are supported.
Circuit said it was not okay. Supreme Court said it was wrong.
Right.
And, of course, in this case, the appellant complains that the ALJ lifted certain segments of analysis.
As long as the findings are supported.
But the ALJ's decision, of course, is not at issue here. It's the ARB's decision.
Right.
The ALJ is an interim step in the administrative process. It's the ARB's decision that is actually at issue here. And there's been no allegation that the ARB did not make an independent assessment of the facts and come up with the right conclusion or come up with a conclusion based on those facts. So in that instance, that argument doesn't apply in any
How about as to the survey at least to the extent that the challenge is made that the department wasn't following its own regulations.
Well, the criticism of the survey is also misapplied, because the survey itself was in reaction to the complaint by the union. And as such, it wasn't meant to apply a prevailing wage post hoc. It was just meant as a way to ascertain the validity of the complaint. It was a normal process that an investigator goes through in order to ascertain whether the union's complaint is valid or not.
Right, but to the extent they're saying, alleging that the department didn't follow its own regulations, wouldn't the court have jurisdiction of that?
To the extent that the claim is that we did not, that the department did not follow the regulations, that goes more into the process area, mm-hmm. of and more into the MSTIC framework than it would be just the frontal attack of the wage determination as we have in this case. But those instances, we feel, and we've maintained below, that those instances, those arguments are nothing more than an attempt to change the classification of the workers, to have the contractor, in effect, be able to say whatever classification it wants to assign, it can assign to these workers, regardless of whether or not the Secretary of Labor has pointed them in the right direction on how to find the proper classification. In this case, it was clear that there's the signpost in the statute, the signpost in the guidance given by Fry Brothers, the signpost in the contract itself, all pointed to in the same direction, that you need to contact the union. If you had questions, you need to contact the Department of Labor. And none of that was done in this case, and that's why we feel that the notice was sufficient, and in this case, actually abundant, in addressing the notice issue. And if there are no further questions, I would ask that you affirm the decision.
How much time is left for rebuttal? Thank you, Council. How much time is left for rebuttal? Pardon?
2 minutes remaining.
Great.
Brief but firm. I don't understand how this could be, statement could be said this is not post hoc when the determination that these hidden rules apply did not come about until 10 years after the project was bid upon, awarded, and indeed performed. This situation puts contractors, particularly non-union ones, in an impossible situation. The reference was made, well, people understand what these notations mean or what the rules are. When 85% of the industry is now non-union, there is no understanding of what the union people are up to. They never confront them anymore. So they have no understanding. That's why the Associate Builders, the leading non-union trade association, filed the amicus brief, is to make the court aware that this is a game of gotcha that the Labor Department is playing, and it's a very serious game for this company, which is out $1.3 million. Over something it had no clue it was doing wrong. It had no notice it was doing wrong. It is not a conformance situation. There is no reason why they would have even thought they should ask for a conformance, because when they look at this wage determination, they would see that there are painters for painting, and there are laborers for laboring, and there are carpenters for carpenting. And all of those classifications are listed here. The notation that refers to the painters' union simply indicates that that's where these work rules came from. And they had every basis for believing that if there were some extra rules, some hidden rules, that painters in this jurisdiction do debris collection, unlike everywhere else, that surely the Labor Department would have seen to it that they were informed at the time of award, as Fry Brothers said they should. That did not happen here. This is clearly a violation of the court's notice requirements, and at a level of specificity that any reasonable person or any reasonable contractor would find to be, baffling. So we ask that you reverse on that ground without a remand. If you do get to the next point, a remand would be required, because clearly under the MSTIC decision, the district court got it wrong by dismissing the case without even considering the record. Thank you.
Case is submitted. Thank you, counsel. Give us a recess.